Good evening, everybody, and welcome to Radio EduTalk. We're broadcasting live from the University of Edinburgh. And tonight I'm delighted to be joined by Rowena Arshad, Kerry Wrigley and Lynn Pratt. And we're going to be looking at a text that we have edited recently entitled Social Justice Reexamined: Dilemmas and Solutions for the Classroom Teacher. If you're listening to the show and the live stream, then you can get in touch two ways. You can email edutalker@hotmail.co.uk, that's edutalker@hotmail.co.uk, or if you're on Twitter and you've got a comment or a question for my guest this evening, then you can put a message, you can put something up on Twitter and just include the hashtag edutalk, edutalk. Tonight's show is going to be around about 30 minutes in length, and it's being broadcast as usual on Radio EduTalk. After tonight's show, the audio will be hosted at edutalk.cc forevermore, so you can pass the link on to your colleagues. And just to start off with, I think it would be helpful if we just go around the table and introduce ourselves. Maybe Rowena, start with yourself.
Hello, good evening. My name is Rowena Arshad. I work at the School of Education. I have worked in the area of equality for pretty much all my life, looking at issues of race, but also anti-sectarian issues and gender. And obviously, I feel very passionate about this area.
My name's Terry Wrigley. I've worked as a teacher and in a local education authority and in the University of Edinburgh here. Retired from there nearly 3 years ago, but it's not really a retirement because I'm still very, very busy. And I mean, my major interest is school change, school development, and the reasons for that and the central importance of questions of social justice. So I'm at present working on various projects, particularly around the issues of young people growing up in poverty.
I'm Lynn Pratt, and I'm responsible for the PGE secondary program within the School of Education. I too was a classroom teacher for a long time. I am responsible. I'm very passionate about social justice as an element of teacher education, which helps to create transformative teachers in the classroom. And we are heartened by the fact that social justice is part of the government agenda for education, but it's also part of the GCC agenda for education and for initial teacher education too.
Thank you. Thanks very much. And just to start off with, for around about the time of the formal launch of this book, Rowena, it would be helpful, first of all, to find out about, I suppose, just cut to the chase. I think one of the major issues that a lot of people in Radio EduTalk talk about these days is about the difficulty of disseminating great works or texts that teachers and student teachers should be using for CPD, professional learning. So first of all, put you on the spot, how are you going to get the key messages of the book out there? But I suppose just before that, could you give us an idea about what the key themes are and some of the great work going on in schools, as well as the kind of theoretical underpinning that's contained in some of the chapters?
Well, I think when we conceived of the idea, David, for this, one of the things I wanted really to do was to actually give confidence, I think, to teachers, teacher educators, student teachers, that actually they can make a difference. And I think sometimes we feel as though we do so much, we don't know the impact, we don't know whether we've got the ability to take forward equality and justice. We don't always see the results of what we do. And actually, this book is an acknowledgement that people have made a difference over the years, and you'll hear stories of that within the book. In fact, you will read about it. But also that we can continue to do so, no matter how small that action is, no matter where we are, which classroom, which school, which authority we're in, we can make a difference. So that is a very key fundamental message from the book. So it's a can-do kind of book. The other side, I think, of the message we wanted was to say to teachers, You know, a lot of us concentrate on looking at the individual child, but we're also equally aware that actually the structures we work in and the constraints that we work in sometimes mitigate against us being able to do more than we want to. So actually it's very important for the teacher to be active, not just at that one-to-one level, but to try and make a change, be an activist, be active within the school, within the authority, and that, yes, you can do it. And so you'll find within the book contributions from teachers who have recently graduated, teachers who have been in the field for longer, academics as well as people who, like Terry, retired, have been doing this for decades and continue to do it into their retirement. The book was originally designed, and the audience we had in mind were student teachers. I have to say that the take-up across the UK, there have been a lot of teacher education institutions taking this up, but another audience that we found taking this up have been childhood practice learners, people who work in the social services field. And I think that's been fabulous. You know, that's a kind of spin-off for us. The student teachers were the original audience. What we've discovered since is actually because the book acts like a portal to a range of equality issues. So when you get the book, you're not just actually looking at gender or race or disability. You're getting a little bit of each. And somebody challenged us when we were writing and said, are you assuming, therefore, that all these issues are the same? Yes, I think there are aspects of the issues that are the same. But what we want to do in the one book is for a teacher or a student teacher to pick it up and say, well, I don't actually know a lot about race. I know quite a bit about gender. I need to know some of the basics of race or sexual orientation or religion, and they can pick the book up and do that. For chartered teachers, which of course is the main audience in this program, I think if you are a mentor, if you are guiding and students, probationers on, you can actually use this book as a trigger to raise issues and discussions with your mentee on this. So I think in that respect, you'll find it useful. In terms of how we're taking the message forward, I'd like to invite people who are listening, but also people who are not listening, but either you may know somebody who might be interested. On Friday, February the 5th, between 1 and 3 o'clock, we're having an event here at Murray House where some of the authors of the book, including practicing teachers as well as other contributors, will be having what I would like to call cafe conversations. So you'll not be coming to a session where you'll be preached at, but what you will hopefully have is practical sessions with some of the authors to explore how these ideas can be developed in the classroom, but also with your colleagues. And you'll have an opportunity to attend and listen to at least two authors in that process. Friday, February the 1st, between 1 and 3 o'clock, if you're interested in coming, please get in touch with myself, Rowena Arshad, at Murray House. So it's rowena.arshad@ed.ac.uk. If you can't remember that, look me up on the University of Edinburgh. Email me if you wish to come. Numbers will be limited, but you've been very welcome indeed.
Thanks, Rowena. And Lynn and Terry, could you just give us expand on some of the themes or some of the social justice issues that Rowena touched on as being in the book? Which chapters stand out for you, and which contributions from practitioners do you think are particularly helpful?
I think Helen Mills' chapter on gender works really well for student teachers. Student teachers buy into the idea of social justice, they're impassioned by it, but it's sometimes very hard to pin those feelings to practice. And I think Helen Mills' chapter, in a very practical, down-to-earth way, suggests ways that you might deal with gender difficulties in the classroom, which you can then take and apply, you know, in your own classroom. That for me stands out as a chapter that I know that student teachers are enjoying and seeing the tension. So that's an easy good one.
Okay. Yeah, I think one of the surprising things about this book, maybe for a lot of readers, will be its tremendous range, because we've grown used to a standard repertoire of books on social justice covering issues connected with race and covering issues connected with gender and sometimes edging into issues of sexuality. But I think that here we've got a book which covers all of those issues. It's got a very useful chapter on teaching pupils with English as an additional language. But it's also, it's got a chapter, the chapter I wrote on poverty and social class, which has become, it is a major issue for education in Scotland, and one that is seriously neglected. It's almost stagnated in terms of sort of policy development and support for teachers in the field, except from the angle of some education authorities. We've got a chapter on Islamophobia, which I think is a wonderful chapter written by a teacher down in Bristol. We've got a chapter on questioning the notion of ADHD, not the appearance of it, but whether it actually is a medical complaint in a way. We've got a chapter on traveller children. We've got a chapter on religion. So there's a tremendous range covered in the book, and I think that's one of its big points. I think the other thing, connecting up with what Lorena said, the chapters are written so that you don't need to have a dictionary in your hand to read them. But that doesn't mean that there's any dumbing down, because I think each chapter is authoritative as well. It starts off from the angle of real dilemmas that teachers face in the classroom, but it opens up and introduces people to a set of ideas that they can rely on for some orientation in dealing with this. And I think it's a great book for people in the chartered teacher position. I know that's been messed up seriously, but for experienced teachers in schools who might be responsible for students coming in and for younger colleagues and to have some influence in the school, I think it's any of the chapters would form a brilliant basis for that.
And why do you feel there's a need for this text? Is it because previous texts have been focused on one particular issue of social justice? Is it to do with the Donald's agenda, that they feel we need to be upping our game? Or is it because, if they want to create a hierarchy of social justice issues necessarily, but Terry's alluding to, or claiming that there's a lack of will or a lack of effort in terms of social justice issues around poverty and social class, do you feel that there is an issue in terms of teachers learning, or is it an issue in terms of what's going on in schools? Why is this book so important at this time?
I think it's a matter of teachers learning and what happens in schools. But I think for myself as a teacher educator, what I really want student teachers to be able to get from a book like this is the fact that they can listen to a range of voices, and those voices are not telling them what they've got to do or how they've got to think, but they are helping them situate their thinking, because that's the difficulty that student teachers have with issues like that. It's a great big issue, and they can see in their classrooms that some people are advantaged or some people are disadvantaged, and that might have to find out often through the social class in lots of different ways. I don't just mean there's the nice cleaning. I mean in terms of literacy, for instance, and home literacy which match school literacy. But it's very difficult, and I remember this from being a teacher myself. You know that there's an injustice there, but how do you discuss it, and how do you work out how you will address it? And I think in your classroom, I don't mean worldwide or school-wide, even community-wide, I mean in your classroom, how will you address it? And I think had I had a book like that when I was a starting teacher or a student teacher, I might have made more sense of some of that and the actions I might have taken more quickly, instead of simply being frustrated. Or I used to work in a school in an area of social and economic deprivation, and I find myself cast as a teacher as either an angel, because I was doing something akin to social work when I wasn't, I was teaching, or being cast as somebody who wasn't a very good teacher because I was teaching in that particular area. So all those things that make you frustrated or require your thinking as a teacher, they're not there for me. And I think that's a very good starter text for somebody to start to think about how to position themselves, and therefore how they might change their practice to secure better outcomes for their learning, whoever they might happen to be.
Well, we did some of our homework before, obviously, writing a book like this, David, and
I think you're right. It's what you were saying earlier, that most books focus on one subject and it goes deeper into it. And I think when we conceived the idea, we wanted a book that gave a feel of the different social justice issues. So I think we used the word, the book is a portal. It is not the be-all and end-all. It's a portal. It's a gateway as a starter. All the writers were asked to nominate a few texts at the end or research pieces that the reader could go on to as the next stage. So I think people can do that. Most of the books that we found that covered social justice issues in any range similar to this were US-based. And actually, we wanted one that was UK-based. And now this one happened to be very heavily dominated by Scottish writers and Scottish teachers. But, you know, that's the by the by. But we just wanted one that was more pertaining to, I think, the UK situation and demographics and issues.
I think one of the delights of the book, of reading the chapters as they came in, was how it was rooted in some very ordinary and everyday situations. And it's just something in Helen Knowles' chapter, who's a teacher in her early career, where she has a sudden crisis because the school's run out of white paper, white photocopying paper. So she hands out the only thing remaining is pink paper, and suddenly there's a revolt by three tough little boys, only primary two. But they say, I don't want pink paper. Oh, why not? Because it's for girls. And she uses this and engages with this and uses this and develops curriculum out of it. Mm-hmm. And part of the discussion in the succeeding days, one of the kids brings up, the advert of Manners knitting shreddies. And so she starts to ask them questions about old people they know and their grandmothers, and are they actually like the image, in this advert? And so they begin to engage in an area of critical literacy in a way that's completely accessible to 7-year-olds and 6-year-olds. And here's something that everybody sort of bolts at. Oh, critical literacy, that's the final stage when you're really, really clever. You might do some critical literacy. But she's doing it there and connecting up with children's lives and raising academic standards here. And I think it's brilliant. And there are all sorts of examples like that.
And it's interesting how contributors come from many different backgrounds. Several are serving teachers or have been in and out, I suppose, of university and schools. So I'm just wondering, is there a kind of commonality in terms of where the contributors come from? Where do they have this passion for social justice? Where do they have a theoretical underpinning of where have these stories come from? Is it because their conscience has been developed, or did they just start being inclined in the first place that they were always going to take that issue with the pink paper and run with it? Where is their understanding and their activism come from? Or is it a whole range of backgrounds?
I suspect it's the whole thing. I mean, we didn't delve into the history of every single person who contributed, but I suspect that, I mean, the thing is that all the people who are listening and all the people who will be listening to this program in future, there'll not be a single person who is not committed to equality and social justice. We all are. And we will come at it from different routes, whether it's from our parents, our community, our faith, our politicization, trade unions, the range. In a way, it doesn't matter. The fact that they've all come to this place is important. And I think the thing for me with the contributors in the chapters is that they've done it regardless of the political context or the financial context. Too often in my line of work, I hear people say, this is all very laudable, Rowena. I do this, but I don't have the time, or this is not a priority in my school, or the real issue here is this, or I don't have enough money to do it. It's all about resources. And yet, for me, what amazes me about this group of people is they do it regardless of all of that. And I suppose it is something to do with the journey of their lives. And I suppose what the book is trying to do is say, actually, we can all be doing this. I do actually think some
teachers as well as students fear engaging with social justice on the basis that they could too high a mountain to climb. And for some social justice issues, in the area that I'm, for example, known for, which is race equality, I think some people think, ah, well, we're in a post-racial world. We have a black president in the United States after all. I'm sure, you know, racism is no longer an issue. Why do we need to do this? So it kind of maybe strays from your original question, but I would hope that whatever the motivations of these various individuals are, the one common thing they actually do have is that they do not see diversity as a deficit or a problem issue. They see it as an opportunity, and that, I think, is great about them.
There is an imperative now as well, that there is a government imperative of these issues. But I said earlier on, the GCC, the new standards for education, of every part of a teacher's development, the opening statement is about social justice and the ability of a teacher to examine themselves in relation to social justice issues. So it's not as if you, in teacher education, we're talking from as a space. These things matter as part, they're seen as part of a teacher's development. And we ask our students online reflexive journal, and you can see now that we've started the fit of the program, which deals in particular with social justice issues, you can see their thinking developing in their journal, you know. And it, for some, it's like, I had never thought of that before. Or for some, it's contesting what's being said. But in fact, and I don't care whether they're contesting what I think is something that is right. I care that they are engaging with it. And that is becoming evident in lots of the journals just now over the past couple of weeks.
Of course, we're recording this on the 12th of December, the very day that the General Teaching Council's new professional standards have been published. Moving on, just put this out here, I certainly feel that each chapter is easy to read. How have you ensured that experienced teachers and those who have previously examined social justice in education will gain something from reading the book?
Well, I think we have done that through the range. I think everybody will have every experienced teacher will have engaged to some extent with some of these aspects, but I think not with the others. So I think that's very important. I think there's new knowledge and new questions even in the familiar areas. And Lynn referred to the issue of the imperative, but it's not just I think it distorts things. If you just think that there's a legal imperative, there's a bottom-up sort of professional imperative to ask questions because of the everydayness of these issues. I mean, a lot of primary teachers will be, let's put it this way, a lot of children from a very early stage in primary schools now are being divided up according to something called ability. Now, that's a common sense word. Everybody uses it. But we don't really ask the question, where does that come from? What is ability? Do we believe that people are born with it? Are we talking about ability? Are we talking about some children having different experiences than others before they come to school? And are there other ways of making learning open to children with a whole range of different experiences and making it accessible without setting up hierarchies, you know, which children then get fixed into. So it's asking questions and opening up, it's inviting people to ask questions about everyday norms in schools, everyday things.
Do you feel there's particular social justice issues covered in the book, Kerry, that teachers with maybe 5, 10, 15 years experience may not have touched upon during their teacher education, or come across through staff, and could you maybe suggest one or two of those?
Well, I think undoubtedly. I mean, it's become the norm. I keep using this word norm, but I think it's important. It's become common sense that there is such a thing as ADHD, and that there are going to be children in every class who suffer, particularly boys, who suffer from something called ADHD. Now, that's become the common sense over the last 10 years. But here we have a very, very experienced writer and researcher and teacher who's really asked, has already published on this question, and is raising the issue of whether there is a condition, a sort of medical condition called ADHD. And I think it's really important for to make that knowledge accessible to to teachers, because we can get trapped in this common sense language and fail to see the particularity of each child who may be troubled by something very, very different. It's important to raise questions about whether a prescription, is the answer to this. I remember asking a Norwegian head teacher, what do you do with the hyperactive child? And she said, it's very simple. They just go for a walk outside. I think, my goodness me, we'd be filling in health and safety forms, we'd be getting absolutely paranoid about this. But yes, in some situations, there might be a different answer. Provide the opportunity for some more active learning, rather than simply put a label on the child and say, you're suffering from something. I mean, I've been in classrooms visiting students on teaching practice, and they've explained to me very, very seriously how those boys over there, you can tell how restless they are. They're suffering from ADHD. We know this already. And these children are 5. Yes. And you ask, well, what have they been doing? And you find that they've been sitting for 3 hours in one way or another, except maybe 4 or 5 minutes after the milk at break time.
Can I maybe put another sort of aspect of this, which is, actually, I think when you're a very experienced teacher, you're expected to be the expert in everything. You're expected to know it all. And actually, it's very difficult for those of us who have been teaching for many years to actually say, actually, I don't really know much about subject X or Y, because either I've not been taught it at teacher education, or actually, I've been so busy, I haven't had time to go and find out about this. So I think you can actually use this book as a bit of a kind of recap for yourself. I specialize in race, very much so. I don't know as much about ADHD. I actually found Gwyneth Floyd's chapter very refreshing to read, and it's given me at least a baseline now to create an argument and to think about these issues. Not to say that I was not pro-disability rights and pro-justice for people and children with disabilities. I was all of that, but I didn't know enough about something. And actually, the other side of it is that, let's face it, we have a certain amount of time, and we are likely to pick on topics that are immediate, what's urgent in our face, or we have a personal interest in. What this book does is, I think, allows you to dip into the other topics that you may not have had a personal interest in. You're supportive of it in theory, but you'd like to know a bit more about it in practice.
Well, certainly, I find it a bit very accessible, and we've said about how it's certainly what's there for student teachers and service teachers. I'm just wondering if some of the terminology, you said that some of the concepts or some of the social justice issues might be new to many teachers. And we discussed earlier on that they're not needing to get the kind of sociology dictionaries out on many occasions, but there's a couple of examples of just looking for some kind of clarification on maybe developed for the benefit of our listeners. Anne McDonald writes of religious normativities, and Shireen Benjamin writes about heterocentrism in schools. Can you just give us an idea about how we should understand these terms?
Well, we were talking about that earlier on, and really I think we've got to understand from the context of the whole book. We're talking about those messages that children receive and that teachers receive about what is normal, whether it's heteronormativity or religious normativity, and the potential marginalising effects of those normal messages. I mean, my subject area, my interest is in literacy, and there are lots of narratives about literacy which exclude other people's literacy or diminish other people's literacy, which we accept. We just the teachers, we accept that literacy means learning to read and write, but learning to read and write in a certain way, whereas other people's literacies may not include reading and writing, and they survive perfectly fine in society without this particular kind of literacy. that would have a message that says, this is the right literacy. And, you know, there's the research into that and the effects of that, and every teacher in a school, to some extent, experiences that when they're thinking about reading and writing as a form of them, as a child demonstrating their knowledge and understanding. And the knowledge and understanding, I'm sure you realize it's in your own experience, that an individual child might be extremely high, but writing it down or reading about it might not be the way that they might go best. If we go back to the question, which is about the norm of civility, that, I think that's what the book is about. It's about thinking about where that normal, that sense of normality might actually be a barrier to some learners in your classroom and how you might then approach it to change that.
It's interesting. And the model covers the idea that, say, children from an atheist or humanist family might suffer in some way in schools, but also then plugs on its head and says that those from Christian families also find difficulties in modern day schools.
Indeed, I mean, that was a difficult chapter. I mean, it's a controversial chapter because not everybody's going to be in agreement with it, because some people might say, well, yes, some people from Christian backgrounds are perhaps sidelined, but actually that is the norm. So if we're challenged, and therefore the power-holding group, then what on earth are we doing, you know, looking at a chapter on these issues? But in a way, what we're doing is raising the discussion, because at the end of the day, if you're a fundamental secularist or a fundamental religious person, either sides of those are going to close down conversations. And so I think we do have to be mindful of the fact that there are people with faith and beliefs, and yes, they can be casted in particular ways, bigotry or bigot or whatever. And yet we know that is not true of everybody with a faith and belief. So I think Anne's chapter is trying to disrupt certain other, perhaps loud voices. They may not be norms, but they certainly are prevalent thinking around. So we don't want to shy away from diverse voices, and I think therefore we give place to that in the book.
I think it's really interesting because I was one of the editors who sort of bulk at this chapter and really struggled with it, because I can see a bigger problem in that formally in schools, it seems that everybody is expected to be religious, if not Christian. And yet, most children won't be, or at least many children won't be, many families won't be. And yet, I think there's an issue really around how freely people can express their beliefs, whatever those beliefs are, whatever those commitments are, in school at more than just a formalistic level. Mm-hmm. And there's a danger that we skate around the issue and we think we've solved it by calling Christmas the winter festival in a way that sort of just simply avoids the issue. Whereas I think we've got to have an openness in school, not just to Christmas, but to Eid and whichever other religious celebrations might be represented there, but also to deeper commitments, like, dare we say, socialism in schools. Where are they? Have we organised schools in such a way that children's deep beliefs are not able to be discussed? So I think that's around where the issue lies.
And Lynn and Rena, were there any chapters that challenged your kind of fundamental or long-standing beliefs or understandings around social justice?
Not hugely, because but I think the chapter that we've just been talking about, and McDonald's chapter, which both argues for the rights of people with religion and beliefs, in particular Christians, but also challenges Christian normativism, actually. That one, I think, was probably the one that caused me, because I had to discuss, argue with Terry about his inclusion. So I think on that basis, I had to really understand why I felt it was needed to be in. I mean, in fairness, actually, I don't think we disagreed about it in any tremendous way, but we did need to have to rationalize and explain why I felt it should be included, in the same way that I think, Terry, you also felt why perhaps it would cause the controversy. And I think that's healthy, because if we can debate that like that, then we hope that the teachers who are reading it can also debate the issue. But Lynn, you may have a different view.
No, I was saying earlier on, that was the chapter that challenged me the business, and I think it comes back to, you know, one in a crowd once said in a conference that I went to, that everybody has their isms. And for me, it was that bit where I thought, why do I feel about this chapter the way that I do? And it is because it was hitting something quite deep-rooted in me that I had to think my way around again. And I would reiterate what you said, I think that's healthy. And I think the diversity of voices in that book make it a healthy book to read as well.
We're just coming into the last few minutes of tonight's show. If you've joined us, we are having a discussion around a new book that's edited by Rowan Arshad, Terry Rigley and Lynn Pratt, and it's entitled Social Justice Reexamined, Dilemmas and Solutions for the Chartered Teacher. Just going back to we spoke earlier about the notion of critical literacies, and I find this an interesting one because from various master's programmes and doctoral studies, actually based here at the University of Edinburgh. But I'm also very interested in ICT in education. And really for me, when I've kind of read around critical literacies, and we've had guests on the show in the past year who have studied new literacies or literacies to a very deep level. And I've always kind of been of the understanding it's kind of linked with 21st century learning and literacies around the kind of digital age that we live in now. And yeah, the term critical literacies, your chapter with Yvonne Foley, seems to relate it entirely to social injustice and using it in a language with, I suppose, Foley's and young people to challenge inequality.
I think it is my understanding of how critical literacy works and why I'm passionate about it is because I think it can empower children and young people. And I think it does relate to 21st century learning, that the 21st century literacy that it's talking about, because it understands that text is more than something that's just written down, and children and young people face text from a number of different, they're bombarded with text. And if they don't know how to question those texts, they are wallpaper with a lot of assumptions and ideological messages which might go unchallenged. And I think unless you know how to challenge those ideologies through asking questions of text and understanding that text is about power, and that every text seeks to manipulate you, however bland it might seem, unless you understand that, then in a society, in a Western society where literatures are very complex in many different forms, you might fall foul of them. And we know, I mean, there's a YouTube clip with the boy that ended up, you know, with the lightsaber dance, you know that? Well, there's a young man who could have sat on YouTube dancing or moving to move it, using a lightsaber. He had to leave the school he that was going message as a result of that. And that, for me, is a misunderstanding of how literacy is literacy. You know, there's not a critical awareness there. And I think that critical literacies in the way that we're talking about it in that chapter is about empowering children to think about what they're doing with literacy, to think about deconstruction for sure, but also constructing, and what that might mean when they put that message out there. There's two classes in Australia that, you know, they're not critically literate, or otherwise they would not, otherwise they would have thought that through a little bit more. And they have no excuse, much older, children are learners. But the understanding of power and how power works in text, which we explore the student teacher here, which we explore the student teachers here, and which we then explore in schools using those student teachers, have very positive responses. Because apart from anything else, that very active approach to literacy engages pupils more than some of the sort of traditional approaches we use in schools. Because you can move between highbrow text and ordinary text, know, you might rate them differently, but you can move between them. You can make it lively for the learners, and you can get them to understand where the power balance sits and how they might counter test in order to change that balance of power. So young people looked after away from home rarely see in the literature they read in schools anything that represents them. And it's very, you know, it's really important that in some texts you see yourself represented. And critical literacy allows you to deconstruct the text about family and change it, rewrite it, recollage it, or whatever, in order to represent yourself and see how that helps situate yourself in the world, to read yourself in the world. I mean, I'm a very happy fairy, and you know, you read the words to read the world, and I think that's at the heart of the teaching that is important to teachers in the 21st century.
I think critical literacy is not an added extra.
No.
It's about asking questions about things that are made to appear. And I'm saying, I just had two new grandchildren in the last 18 months, and it struck me again, you know, how you can hardly buy any clothes for a boy without it being like tough guy at 6 months old, or for a girl, you know, without it being so pink and silly. And, you know, walking through the big toy store, it's so strongly gendered one way or another. Watching the adverts on one of the commercial children's television channels, you know, it's so strongly gendered. There's this way of being a boy, there's this way of being a girl. And so critical literacy is not just even about books. It's about the aisle in a toy store and what's available, or in a clothes shop. It's about asking questions about what you see on TV. Yeah. And I think unless you're helped through your schooling to ask those fundamental questions, then really you're only partly educated and not growing towards this citizen that the curriculum for excellence is asking us to develop in schools.
And critical literacy is in curriculum for excellence, but it's not very well or very detailed in a very detailed way. It's good, but this encouragement is there. Understanding a text, for instance, is literacy and cover, literacy and language is cover paper. You know, it's there, and it's our job now to take it further.
I wonder if we might finish, actually, because I'm realising that you're running out of time, with actually the quote that we opened up in our first chapter in the book, and I'm going to just read this out. It's actually by a teacher called Charlotte Epstein in 1986. This quote probably was earlier, and she said, "We can educate the next generation to solve many of our problems if we're courageous enough to free them from our own prejudices and anxieties." In that same text, she also talked about the importance of teaching our students not to leave school with inclination to believe, but rather with the ability to question.
That's a fantastic quote to finish on. I'd like to thank our three guests again for taking up taking some time out tonight to talk around the group that's out just now. I suppose, Rowena, you've mentioned about the event on the 1st of February and about how listeners can get in touch after the show. If you've got any queries about the event or want to take forward their learning in this area, can you just give people a heads up in terms of where they can actually obtain the book?
Well, they can either... I'm going to say it's a bit controversial at the moment. You can either buy it from organisations that don't appear to pay their taxes, which is Amazon, or you can get it, I think, from Trentham
directly,
which is the publisher, and the Trentham publishers,
Trentham
Books, which I think would be our preferred option to advertise the book. If you have any problems at all getting hold of it, do get in touch with me, because we can probably get you copies as well.
The Trentham website is www.trentham-books.co.uk.
Thank you very much, and until next time, goodbye.